Thank you for that, Holly, for praying that, playing, I should say, that prayer, Nearer, My God, to Thee, the song they sang when the Titanic was going down. That was a different day than we have today. I was listening the other day to someone, I can't remember what program it was on, but this young guy there with his long hair and his disheveled look and his three-day beard and T-shirt declaring how open the people of the United States are to God. And I'm just wondering, what is his assessment of that? This has been, you know, there have been greater days in the United States. There have been more fateful days. And at the beginning of the 20th century, in fact, the days were so fateful at the beginning of the 20th century that there were Christians who were saying that the 20th century will be the Christian century. Well, of course, you do understand that there was more war in the 20th century than in any other century. More people were killed. And at the end of the 20th century, here we are into the 21st century when we can't even determine who's a male and who's a female. And all manner of perversion is presented as that which is right and that which is honorable and that which is moral. And we who stand against such things are the immoral ones. Well, but there was a day when these men were sure they were dying. I mean, this was it, no hope. All the boats were gone. The boat, the ship going down, and they would, in these icy waters, would drown. And sang their faith. They said that those that were in the lifeboats could hear them singing. What a different day. What a different day. And yet, throughout history, the Lord has done this. Some generations He blesses immensely. Some He almost takes away every vestige of it. I mean, the candle is flickering almost to being extinguished. But then the Lord reaches down and touches His people. We are one generation from being obsolete as Christians, because unless the Lord saves, there won't be any Christians. We'll die. We who are Christians will die. Then there won't be any more. But that won't happen, because He has His people of every generation. And often when we come to a time, as it seems as if, especially the United States, that the earth is in now, where we've turned our back on God, that often it gets to such a level before God is ready to unleash again a revival. The history of Christianity is the history of revival, an ebb and a flow, a build and a decline. And we're on a decline. I don't know how much further we will decline, but we are on a decline. That even those that seek to do right don't seem to be able to do right. But at one point, somewhere, somehow, it will all be changed. Because we in the United States, and we who are here now, we are really living on the capital of the Second Great Awakening, because there's been little periods, little time, where the Lord, for example, 1859, the prayer revival. But Lloyd Jones mentions that. In fact, he preached a number of sermons on revival at the 100th anniversary of that in 1959. But But basically, we're living on that capital. The Second Great Awakening happened in the 19th century. So except for a few periods of time, we've gone a full century. And now we're into the next century. We are at the end of the second decade of the 21st century. And we're still seeing a great decline, as manifested in the sexual revolution. And then, of course, you know, and you know it's going to happen. The great controversy now is this streaming service called Netflix has now put out a show. I don't know if it's a series or if it's a movie or whatever. And I think my understanding came out of France, or at least those that were putting it together. The idea began in France, I guess. And so it is demonstrating. Now, there's some controversy. Say, well, they're speaking against pedophilia, that, you know, sexualizing pre-pubescent girls, you know, 10, 11-year-old girls, through their dancing. But I don't know. You know, someone said you need to watch it. Well, I don't care to watch it. Just write a review on it and let me read what it's about. But the point is, I think it begins, if I'm not mistaken, with some people sitting around talking about morality and how modesty, great modesty is, and then ultimately to end up in this movie. Well, I don't know, you know, what the writer, the producer, the director, the actors of this movie are trying to do, but my understanding is it is absolutely obscene, and that here we are, and now it's pedophilia. I mean, you know it. I knew it. We are we're just moments away from someone, you know, saying, going to the court and getting their, getting some judges to say that, you know, that they are born, whatever, that they have a right to this, and so they ought to be able to marry children. You know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. I don't really know if we'll ultimately come to our senses to stop this, or will the Lord just simply destroy us. But here it is. And I remember we used to talk about things. We said, well, what's going to be next? And they would say, oh, you're just, you know, the slippery slope argument. Oh, you know, you're just, that'll never happen. That'll never, and then it's happening. I don't put anything beyond the perversion of a fallen mind. None. Nothing. And of Satan that gets the church on the run. Because I can tell you this, if they ever get you on the run, you'll keep running. And there are those that want to say, you know, that we have to lessen what we're doing. We can't preach this old message. We can't preach this Bible. Because first of all, they won't tolerate it. They just won't listen to it. Look, we want, you know, $3 worth of God. Or we want truth in, you know, in 15-minute segments. Anything beyond that, who's going to listen to such a thing? Well, that has always been the temptation. The temptation to the preacher, the temptation of the preacher has always been, don't be too biblical. That won't work in today's society. So you have to change up. You have to be different. Well, I don't know what works and doesn't work. It seems like to me that the least you give people, the bigger you grow as so-called churches. I mean, I do understand that. However, That just adds to the temptation. There's no biblical reason that we should, you know. And I've asked people, when people say, well, I don't know if this is right or that's right or if I agree with it. And I said, well, give me a biblical reason why we should not be doing this. To which they usually just get angry at you because they don't have a biblical reason. And so, but we must give ourselves to these truths. We must give ourselves to what the Lord would have us do. We don't need to be doing surveys and polls to figure out what we should offer people at the church. We should offer them the truth. We should preach. We should worship. He said, well, they won't come. Well, maybe you're right. But let's say we don't give them truth. Let's say we pander to them. Let's say we just make it to where it's, you know, it's palatable to their humanistic palate. And we get a bunch of people. What have we done? What have we done? If we leave them in their sin, we might as well have left them in the world. At least if they were in the world, they wouldn't have some excuse. I mean, you know, there are people that can get just enough religion to block them from righteousness because they have religious answers, you see, and they act religiously because they've learned religion. I was listening this morning as I was going to get the donuts. I was listening to L.R. Shelton Sr. And L.R. Shelton Sr., you know, was preaching, saying, you know, that you know, they don't want you to preach the truth anymore. I mean, and so he's preaching this back in the 60s, you see. Want you to preach the truth anymore. They don't want you to... They won't hear it. They won't listen to it. They won't believe it. You see. And he said, you know, that the worst thing that you can contend with in the church are unregenerate religionists. Yeah, I would contend that that is true. Just enough answers to block themselves. You see, my understanding of a flu vaccine or any viral vaccine is that you give them a dead strain. The vaccine gives the person a dead strain of the flu. Or I guess they're working on a dead strain of COVID-19. So they can inject it into the body, and once the body sees and attacks this dead virus, when the living virus comes, it will recognize it and destroy it immediately. Now, that's my understanding of what a vaccine does. What an appropriate illustration of false religion. See, we inoculate people with false religion. And it indeed inoculates them from the living strain. So they have the answers. But not the heart. They have the morality. But they're not born of the Spirit. So what are we to do? Well, I'm determined to do one thing, to continue to do that which is right, continue to do that which is biblical, and to pray for the Lord to give to us, the church of Jesus Christ, those who he transformed. And only through this gospel is it. Now, here's how you know that you've been transformed by the power of the gospel, is that your life has changed. Like I said to them this morning in the Sunday school class, Life always manifests itself in living. So if you have a new life in Christ, it will manifest in your living. Now, as I've wrestled with putting this stuff together, as I told you last week, maybe putting some of this stuff together in a longer form of a book, what would I call that book? Would I call it four levels, basic four levels of government? That doesn't sound very exciting, does it? Or would it, what could I call it? Could I call it contact points? These are the contact points of the Spirit. Or, would you define it in some sense of the influences of, four undeniable influences of the gospel? But whatever we would call it, this is where God meets us. Christianity, being born of the Spirit, is being ultimately met by God, by the power of God, and transformed. It's not just simply making someone a religionist or just giving them a vocabulary of religion. It's not about just simply getting one area of their life correct and let the other areas kind of take care of itself through whatever processes the other area would, through education or through logic or through philosophy, or through whatever man can devise, through industry, through effort. But the Christian life is not that. We know that Christianity takes in all of life. It is a transformation. It is a new mind. It is a new heart. It is a new will. It is new desires. It is new goals. It is a new way. In fact, I used to call it the way. It can't just simply be a reclamation, a reclaiming of the old way. It's not just about remodeling. It's about resurrection. It's about a total restoration. So this is what the Christian life does. And I'm afraid a lot of people in this society don't want to hear that. They treat religion as a hobby. And they just throw it in to the other hobbies that they do. So if we don't have the hobby of some athletic competition, or we don't have the hobby of going to professional football games, or if we don't have if that is our hobby and it's not today, then I'll come to church, or I have the hobby of camping, or the hobby of fishing, or the hobby, whatever it might be, it competes with the hobby of religion. So that's why some people would just as soon go and do some hobby as to come and worship God. It's not that they're against worship, and it's not even that they hate worship. It's not even that they are resistant or that they are resentful of it. It's just not their life. And those of us who it is our life, they simply call us fanatics. Or that we just, they just take it a lot further than you really need to. Hey, because I've heard this more than once, and from numbers of different people who say to me, well, I'm a Christian and I don't do that. Well, they don't do that. They got that part right, but do they have the other part right? Can you be a Christian without being thoroughly transformed by the power of Christ? Different thinking, different affection, different motives, different goals. Spurgeon. In fact, I heard L.R. Shelton Sr. this morning quote this, without attribution, by the way. But he quoted this. He said, people will have God, will have the Lord anywhere but on a throne. Well, that's Spurgeon. Now, I don't know if Spurgeon got it from somebody and didn't give attribution, but the first time I read it was Spurgeon, that people will have Jesus anywhere but on a throne. They'll have him in a manger as a baby, as a gift. They'll have him in the streets doing miracles and the armory, you know, giving gifts to people. They'll have him on the cross, dying. They'll have him in the tomb. They'll have him in heaven. But where they will not have him is on a throne, claiming your life. Is he Lord? I mean, you remember this. This is not anything that I thought of. This has been said by a lot of people, and maybe it's been said by a lot of people because it's just so common to think, if Jesus Christ is not Lord of all, he's not Lord at all. So here, he comes in, and he's making claims over all your life. So, and we're calling this levels of government, but we could call it points of contact. What's the first point of contact? Well, the salvation of your soul. That's the first point of contact that the Lord has with you. I mean, I guess we could say he created us, but when we're talking about being regenerated, when we're talking about being a child of God, the first point of that is this salvation. It's when he comes in and claims your life. Okay, so what are you? Well, you're an individual. You're male and female. Yes, male and female, born of God, male and female. That's where you are. And sometimes he comes and claims that life early when you're a young person, when you're in your, you know, before I ever reached my teens, I began to sense the call of God upon my life, and not only the call to salvation, but I had some sense of the call to being a pastor, which was kind of strange because I never really wanted to be that. In fact, I've told you this in my testimony. When I began to feel the urge to become a pastor, when I began to feel that call, I began to beg God, not that, please let me be misreading this. I don't want this. I will be a good church member. I might even consider being a deacon. You know, I will give a tithe. I will worship them. I will raise my children. Please don't call me to this. But he did. And not only was that my assessment, but that was the assessment of almost every person that I met in the church. Even young people would say to me when I was a young man, you're going to be a pastor. I remember talking to a young man. I told you this a few weeks ago, or at least I told someone this. His name was Chuck Fresina. He's Italian. His daddy owned a laundromat right there by the church that ultimately I became the pastor of Trinity. But anyway, so when I was in high school, Chuck was a good, a friend and acquaintance. We talked, and I asked him, I said, well, Chuck, I never seemed to get invited to your parties. He said, what would you do at our parties? You're not that kind of guy. This is the kind of guy you are. Telling me what kind of guy I was. You see, you're going to be a pastor. You're going to be a preacher. You're different. Well, so it was not my assessment. It was other, even this young man who probably wasn't even a Christian. But here's this claim he makes on. At 8 years old, he made this claim on me. Now, I surely didn't live perfectly. And in fact, I'll be honest with you, some things I did after I felt that initial call of the Lord, I feel a lot of shame for. I still bear that shame. Even shame of things that I did in naivety. Just in juvenile naivety. But I still, when I think about them, I hate them. Why couldn't I have been better than that? I do believe that when you're a child, you think as a child and you act as a child. And I think that children who come to faith early come to a child faith that has to grow into a man faith or a woman faith. And that's why I think we see a lot of children at first in churches, you know, when they're younger, when they're 8 or 9 or 10, you know, or 11 or so, they do what we want them to do and what they hear us praying over them to do, that is to become a Christian. So they want to please us, so they do. And they're not phony. I don't think they're phony. Look, I know we've had some young people to leave our church and they're not living a Christian life now, but I do not believe that those moments when they confess Christ with their mouth, that they were being phony. I don't think they were being phony. Now, was it a salvific confession? Well, I guess time will tell. But we do know it was a child faith that must grow. And see, and I'll be honest with you, especially when I sat under these Arminian preachers that used to hammer you because they wanted to get you down the aisle and they wanted to get you in their baptismal numbers. And they would hammer you about, you know, if you've ever done anything at all wrong after you become, you are not really a Christian, which is absolutely, you know, it's not right. It's we wrestle with the flesh as the spirit. That's not right. And a lot of, I mean, there have been a lot of pastors and a lot of evangelists that could be sued for pastoral malpractice and harming people's, by holding them to an unbiblical standard that they don't even hold themselves to. Well, anyway. And I sat there and I was hammered by that stuff. And I said, well, I was in such a fix that sometimes in my life I'm sitting in congregations and churches saying, well, did I say the right words? Because we had preachers that said, you know, that I remember one pastor in particular, he said, you know, I went down, joined the church, but I didn't say the right words. You know, I said, I want to join the church. I didn't say I wanted to be saved. I want to join. I didn't say I want to come to Christ. I said, I wanted to join the church. And so I wasn't saved because I'm thinking, did I say the right words? Roman Catholicism could not put you under any more guilt than that. But I came to the conclusion that if the Lord had drawn you, I mean, we did what we were told to do. Come down here and tell us. You didn't have to go down there. There's no salvation down here. It's in the Lord. Now, you might want to come down here and tell people that the Lord. But again, but I came to this conclusion. If I walk down and grab the preacher's hand in faith, I mean, the Lord has saved me and I'm making a confession before the church, I could have said mashed potatoes and gravy. But it's not in these words. But as I assessed my life, here's the one thing that kept me confident that I am the child of God. Because that which began in me at 8 years old is still in me at 65 years old. See? And has grown. Where God touched me. And then, of course, the next level is in this family, you see. I was in the family as a child. I was honoring my father and my mother. I was obeying them. I wanted to do that which was right. I wanted them to have, you know, to be proud of me, the way I was living. I wanted their favor, even as I wanted God's favor. I didn't do it simply to get their favor, but I wanted their favor, just like I want God's favor. The motivation was this new life, but still I wanted that favor. And I'll just be honest with you, I never really had any problem whatsoever submitting to my father. I never had any resentment of him. In fact, I would have to believe, of all the people in the world that have been my friends, he has been my best friend. In fact, when I got married, he was my best man. Because he was my best man. Now, but my relationship with my mother was not quite that way. My mother had, you know, and I'm using this as an illustration. I honored her and love her. Still honor her and love her. But she did have a way of getting next to you. I mean, she purposed at times she had a mean spirit. But, and she really knew how to get to me. But, in fact, I remember one time when she looked at my wife, Paula, and said, "Paula, if I told you that the grass outside was purple, you'd agree with me, wouldn't you?" And Paula said, "Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am." Well, but I honored her. And there was times when I could have bitten a 12-penny nail in two. But then I remembered. Not only did I remember who I was as a child of God to honor her, but I remembered that at 3 years old, she was crying for her mother, and her mother was dead. So, they used to say that some people were raised and some people were snatched up by the hair of their heads. She was one of those. But she met my father by the grace of God. And my father was the person she needed. And it worked out well. And we honored her to the moment of her death. And it was difficult at times, but it was right. So I had to learn as a child, you see. I had to learn as a child how to be in this family. And then I found a wife. The other day, we were driving around, and Logan and Luke were in the car with us, and we went around to all the places in Baton Rouge that were the places that we, you know, like Paula would say, "But this is where Granny was born." And And then, so we were driving down and we were looking at some houses. And we came across Paula's mother and daddy's home there on St. Anne. And I said, Luke and Logan, that's where I found Granny. And Logan said, really? And you saved her for later? I guess I did. Because she was young. And I saved her for later. Well, you see, then, okay, so now I'm in the family as a husband with a wife. And the Lord is teaching me how to live with her according to knowledge. And then we had children. See, our plans were that I was going to finish LSU, graduate from seminary, get a church, and we would start a family. So that's what our plans. We graduated. I graduated from seminary with two children. So of all the plans of mice and men, right? But then I had to learn how to be a father. I'll never forget. And I had to spend the rest, I had all my money for college saved all of a sudden. And I had to spend that money on this little child that they handed me. And I didn't know what to do with him. So that's when you say, Mom, I didn't. But I remember looking at him thinking, 18 years? Well, it actually turned out to be longer. I had to learn how to be a father in the family. So what's my responsibilities? And so that's these responsibilities in the family as mother and father standing before the children. And I've given you all of these except the last one, the responsibility of education. And so I'll give that to you more clearly next Sunday morning. But I also want to preach next Sunday morning on the subject of how to be the spiritual leader of your home. I don't think I can leave family government without preaching to you how to be a spiritual leader of your home. Now, that'll help the young fathers in the congregation. That will help the young people in the congregation, those who will become a father, hopefully, a husband and a father. And these young ladies who will become wives and mothers, of what she should look for in this man. And then it will help those who have grandchildren and who have a wife. I mean, it's never too late. Never too late to become the spiritual leader of your home. And so I think I need to talk to you about that. Well, it begins when Christ saves you. It doesn't end there. You see, if you would listen to most preachers, you would think that the end of this, if we get you in the church, then we've got you. No, my friend, that's the beginning. The preacher's responsibility begins there. It doesn't end there. It begins there. And he must tell you, if he is going to be faithful to Christ and to the church of Christ, and if he's going to be faithful to you and to your interest, he must teach you these things. Though it would be much easier for me just to leave people to figure it out themselves. But I could not do that. I couldn't do that to you, nor could I do that to the Lord. And so that's my responsibility to you. And so we will continue this as we move from the family to the church and then to the civil government. Because God's touching us at every one of these places. Let's pray.